Our presentation today is A Young Man's Odyssey Through Mexico by John Gernandt. This is based on John's memoir, which has just been published, The Troubled Traveler. John has worked in the field of special education and human behavior, construction management, and he has also worked for 50 years as a furniture maker. He's currently doing retail sales at Dorn's Hardware, where he knows everything. He's also been my husband of over 40 years, and it has been an honor to be married to this man. The things he talks about today that he learned in Mexico, kindness and compassion, and not being non-judgmental, have helped us through 40 years of challenges and love.
This is not a book launch. I'm gonna talk about the things that I learned through the odyssey of becoming a young man into adulthood. A young man's odyssey has to include some things. From a young man to become an adult, to become a man, he has to go through fear, courage, socialization, and risking. And real kindness. Today's children are being raised by helicopter parents who hover over them, protecting their children from discovering their strength when meeting real life experiences. Teenagers today are so connected to their cell phones, thinking they're going to discover life on a 4x3-inch screen. Hundreds, if not thousands, of boys in juvenile detention being raised by jail guards without parents, and never having any real life experiences. How can we expect them to meet adulthood, to be fathers, teachers, and leaders? I did not learn the lessons that I've learned living at home, where everything was a complete catastrophe. Having a neurological brain disorder no one knew about, but only thought they were behavioral problems. Spending years looking for approval and not finding it. The stigma of constantly being accused of behaviors that I had no control over. It was so painful that I had to find a way out. I had a chance to change who I was perceived as. When my parents dropped me off at the airport, headed towards Mexico City, my goal was not to fail, to complete whatever it was I was doing or going. Fear. After landing at the airport in Mexico City, I finally found someone who could direct me to a hotel with not having to spend the night on the streets. We talked a bit. She referred me to the Hotel Gina. She writes out directions. I take off on foot. It now is becoming dark. The street signs are hard to read. Crowds of people fill the streets. I walk for several minutes, turn the corner, and there stands the Hotel Gina, a 5-story hotel not far from downtown. Rooms are only $10 a night. I have no problem checking in. They don't bat an eye that I don't have a credit card or my age or my long curly red hair. I receive a key, a slip of paper explaining the checkout procedures, which thankfully were all in English. When I get to my room on the 5th floor, the window is open to the street. It's loud. I hear yelling. The sounds, what I've perceived to be gunfire. The 1968 Olympics are in Mexico City this year, which explains the sizable crowds in the street. Looking down, I see a large group of people coming up the middle of the street, protesting some aspect of the Olympics. Moving toward them are men dressed in military uniforms, carrying weapons, and yelling at people to get off the street and onto the sidewalk. I don't understand their words, but it is apparent, even from my window, that there is not enough room on the sidewalk for all the people to move to. In mass confusion, suddenly, the uniformed men start to shoot anybody unable to get onto the sidewalk, men, women, and children. are dying right in front of me. Having lived close to Los Angeles during the 1965 race riots, I knew these things happen, but they're not supposed to happen in front of me. I long for a moment for an adult to tell me what I'm seeing, to confront and console me. I hunker down in my room for several hours, away from the windows, trying to be safe. It occurs to me that this morning, I was a 16-year-old boy with his parents. Now, I am the same kid, but watching people die right in front of me. I can't communicate with anyone without sign language. After a bit of restless sleep, I walk to the bus station as dawn breaks, figuring I might as well be there than anywhere else. And though I feel like I'm sitting here like a homeless teenager with no destination and people staring at me. After an hour on a wooden bench waiting for the bus, I begin to relax and think what being a stranger in a strange place is. It's not so bad after all. I know no one. I have a blank slate. I can be anyone I want. I don't have to be a bad boy anymore. I'm a fresh face, feeling better. I sit up straight and think, screw everybody. You don't know me. You can't think bad things about me. Courage. When something fearful comes up, you have to learn how to take courage and move forward. After I met the Burujas at the marketplace and went to their grass huts, he asked me to remove my shirt, shoes, and socks in hand, and hands me a tea-colored liquid to drink. Within 5 minutes, I can hear and see, but my body is ice cold. I'm scared. I try to move, but I can't. The Brujos place several turkey legs on my stomach and roll them back and forth across my chest, stomach, and legs. Then the Brujo, sprinkles crushed bones on my chest. Finally, he puts on a mask of a deformed animal and begins to chant. Chanting is loud and slow, with a strange pitch alternating between highs and lows. They leave me alone in the hut with four or five bowls of bark burning, filling the air with a smoky haze. The hut has no door, only a 2'5" opening, allowing enough smoke to escape to keep me from being overwhelmed. Later that evening, a different woman enters my room with cooked eggs and a spoon and feeds me like I'm a sick, small child. Before leaving, she takes a flat piece of wood and lays my hair from my back onto the wooden plank, and with a knife, she chops off a handful of my curls and leaves me overnight with a blanket for warmth. My mind is clear enough to know I need to leave. Yet I remain there, laying on a wooden slab, not able to get up. No one knows I'm there. I hadn't left an itinerary with anyone, because itineraries at the time weren't my style. I want to write something to let my family know I had not forgotten them. At the same time, I believe I can handle this. I will somehow get out of this mess. Socialization. Not knowing how to socialize with people, not knowing how to present yourself, to look someone in the eye, to do those things. You have to be able to do that, to find food, to find shelter, to find direction, safety, and everything else that comes in a journey. After leaving the Isla de Mujeres, not showering for a week, in the belief that cleaning up in the ocean was sufficient, was incorrect. I'm clean, but carrying a thick crust of salt over my body and hair. My skin feels itchy and uncomfortable. I need to rent a cheap hotel, shower with soap and water, and have my clothes clean. Puerto Juarez has few amenities, and my clothes are dirty, justifying me to pay someone to clean them. There are no laundromats in southern Mexico. Laundry is done by home, a service you find by asking around. The hotel manager knows where to find laundry services, and is a bit stunned to have a young white boy with long red hair ask for laundry service like a local. I had learned to travel light, two pairs of pants, two white shirts like those worn by Indian working men. My two pairs of socks were disgusting. I quit wearing underwear, a garment that was too much trouble for the way I was traveling. Needing to clean my clothes, even the ones I was wearing, I had to gather my clothes, wrap myself in a towel. I had not perfected the towel wrap, and it tended to fall off every time. I put a belt over my towel and walked over to the manager's room. I was told my clothes will be done and ready later in the afternoon. I lounge in my room naked all day. Luckily, I had reading materials and maps to study. There was no TV. There was no radio in my room. Late in the day, I hear a knock on the door, adjusting my towel, fastening my belt. I open the door. At the door is a woman with a package wrapped in newspaper. She could not have been over 4.5 feet tall, with an innocent, sweet smile. She lifts the package just high enough to not bother me having to bend over. Not knowing the cost of the laundry service or speaking her dialect, I open my wallet and motion for her to take out what I owe her. Shyly, she took out 5 pesos. The exchange rate at the time was 14 pesos to the dollar. It came to 40 cents. I can't do that. I open the package on the table, each piece of clothing cleaned, dried, pressed, and meticulously folded. Knowing that to press clothes on an iron had to be heated by a hot coal. She must have had worked hours on the job. I pull a 20 peso bill out of my wallet and hand it to her. She backs off, interfering that it's too much. I felt so privileged that she did this for me. Leaning forward, I place a bill in a small bag she is carrying. Ma okay, pat a tik, a bin. That is thank you for safe travel and hot water. I don't know that was her language, but she seemed to know what I was saying, or at least the spirit of the words. Meeting new people is, meeting new people under different environments and dynamic environments. When I got off the airplane in Citala, I met the mayor, and he walked me a short distance to the Atat home of one of the elders, who asked me, Noka, sit down. I sat on the dirt floor while Marcus explained to the 4 men who I was and what I was doing. The men smiled, nodded their heads. One man passed me water and a small squash gourd cut in half into a bowl, which was used for drinking water. It was evident that the men were upset. With one man leaving, I could see by the way they were speaking to each other that something was not right. Marcus motioned to me to come outside. He looked concerned. I got up and walked out the door. He explained to me that the water is not to drink. It is used to cleanse one's mouth from expelling evil words that would come out of my mouth. The tradition is to swish the water and spit it onto the ground. Swallowing the water is like swallowing your own waste. What have I done? Probably more than anything is being able to accept a risk. Risking is something you just can't get away from. And sometimes we just got to take that step, whether we like it or not. It may even mean life or death, but sometimes we have to take that risk. Passing through the door with a sign saying Neuropsychiatric Surgery Center, I felt scared and out of place. The shaman witch doctors in the jungles of Chiapas were less frightening than this place. Even the smells of the shaman caves with hundreds of herbs, bones, and ground up ground-up insects was more pleasant than the surreal disinfectant smell of the medical center. Dr. Crandall met with us in his office. He said, the surgery that I'm looking at taking has only been done 22 times in the world. Not all surgeries had been successful, but all patients at least showed some improvement. There were many serious side effects that could emerge after surgery relating to speech, vision, and cognitive functioning, somewhat like a lobotomy. Some side effects were mild, others were not. Back home, we had the discussion about many of the terrible side effects. Before we even finished the conversation, I rushed to my room, buried my face in a pillow, thinking about everything that I had learned and what had happened over the last 4 years and how it came to this enormous decision. I was scared and uncertain, but reminded myself I was capable of handling whatever might come in front of me. I ran downstairs, found my parents, and said, I'll do it. Let's move forward. My odyssey taught me a lot of lessons, but I came out of it. I'm here now. I'm ready. I'm moving for 50 years after the surgery. I ended up being their most successful patient ever. Never had another surgery and never had a single side effect, I don't think. Anyhow, the book I wrote is about all these adventures and what I learned from them. And what I tell my kids and what I feel I got out about this most and what I'd like to see in them is that I can drop them off anywhere in the world, pick them up and drop them anywhere in the world without a dime in their pocket and without a word to speak in someone else's language. And I'll be okay. I'll do it. Thank you. My wife's looking for a compliment, because this book would have never been written without Suzanne. She has much more control over the English language than I have. I was asked for years to write a book. People said, write a book, write a book, write a book. And all of a sudden, about 3 years ago, I sat down and wrote the book. I don't know why it was that moment, but I did it. And it's a long journey in itself. I think you write a book about 4 times. You write it and rewrite it, and then you edit it by the chapter, by the page, by the paragraph, and then by the word. So it took about 2.5 years to put it on all the paper. And throughout the book, I use a lot of the Tistel language, and I had to research that. It's almost impossible to find any dictionary or anything like that of the Tistel language. In fact, I tried to find someone in Wisconsin. I don't speak fluent Tistel, but I found out I was the only person in Wisconsin that spoke any Tistel. So I was picking coffee, and we picked up all the coffee. We got it over to the feed stalls and everything like that. And then we brought it, hiked 8 to 10 miles, donkeys and 100-pound bags of coffee, to a little trail. And we waited for a truck that came by about once a year to collect the coffee. We didn't really know what day it was coming or what hour, but we knew it was within a week or so. So we went to the trail, and we stayed there. We just stayed and waited for it to come. No communication with anything. And I made the mistake of sitting down. And they looked at me, and they go, I forget the name of the word. And it was, stand up, stand up. And I go, well, why? All the insects and snakes and everything, you have to stand up. So I stood up, and then I did the Americans thing of you start dancing and like that. You know, you're walking around. And they were all looking at me going, I pick, dancing. And Marcos came over, and he goes, and hinted to one of the guys, would you show this guy how to stand? And it was amazing. Stand here with your hands to your side, about like that, and you push your thighs back. You push them back. And your knees forward a little bit. Lock your thighs, don't let your knees fall. And it's like locking yourself like a horse. You can stand here all day, and it feels perfectly comfortable. Now, on the other part, you have to have a smile. It's one thing I learned from working them too. You can work for you work all day. You can go up the biggest hill and be as tired as you can be. Keep a smile. And the other thing was, never stop. You can be tired. You can be going up a hill this big. Don't stop. You can go slow. You can move an inch at a time. Never stop. Always keep a smile. Sometimes at the grocery store when I'm waiting, I stand there like this. At 16 years old, I probably had the opportunity to deliver over 20 or 30 babies. Not all by myself, but being there with the thing. And it was a great experience. It was a happy experience for people. A lot of times, I just stood with that father, the happy father. And we usually stood right there. Or I'd go get hot water or this or that or antibiotics or a suture kit if I needed it or something like that. A lot of the women had pole bursts. It seemed like any woman whose mother delivered with a pole, they also delivered a pole. And we had a full pole station with a big pole. They could squat and pull on the pole and give birth. And I was involved in a lot of those. Held a lot of newborns in my hand. Cut a lot of umbilical cords. That was one of the better parts of the whole 4 years I was there, was helping mothers give birth. Well, the people there, the Pistol people, were absolutely the nicest people in the world. I mean, they were just the most friendly people. They didn't have the problems we have. In fact, when I left, all the Pistol people do is they do farming, they build, they grow food, play music, and make love. That's all. There's no TV, there's no cars, there's no roads. Citala was 450 miles from the nearest store where you could buy something. So they just had a perfect little life. And they wanted everybody to have another life, but they were just welcoming to everybody. I had dinner almost every night with another family or this or that, and they were just so happy to hear about where I'm from and what I'm doing. And anytime I needed any help with language or how to pick coffee or how to do this, they were there without judging me or anything. I was having seizures then. Nobody said a thing to me. They said, go ahead. You know, there's a lot of handicapped people with disabilities in Mexico, even more so in the jungles. They have club feet, this and that, hearing problems, speech problems, seizures and everything. But you're just there. If you can't do this, we'll find something for you to do. It was never a sense of there's a problem with you. You're just having a difficulty. People were amazing. In fact, picking coffee was fun. I don't know if you've ever picked coffee, but you have to do it just right. So the coffee tree isn't very tall. It's only about 8 feet tall. And you have to go in. They have a bag you wear that fits under your elbow. And I was picking coffee, which was a big mistake. You get up in the tree, and you take your fingers and you wiggle them. And the beans start dropping. And you put your elbow just right, so they roll down your arm and fall into the mic. And they had it perfected. They very seldom drop a bean. I was just like this, and beans were going on. I learned pretty good how to do it. Well, I don't remember all of them. I wrote the ones that I did. And some of these things, you couldn't forget. And I did, sometimes there were a few things that were that I forgot or that there was a gap. And I embellished some of those things, but I tried to keep everything just the way it was or as close to what I thought it was. the UCLA, I had front temporal lobe epilepsy, which when I was diagnosed was called psychomotor epilepsy. And that was about 1964. It was the first, I mean, the doctors saw it and they had to gather with each other to talk about it. It was a brand new thing. Not that the psychomotor seizures were a brand new thing, but they were just starting to be diagnosed and understood. And it was, so what they did is they put me in UCLA Medical Center for 9 months, drilled 16 holes in my head, and inserted 16 electrodes, like an EEG, but they were deep implants. And Dr. Crandall was the first doctor in the world to do deep implants in a human being. And this was to discover the location of where they had figured the seizures were originating from. So I had a helmet or something about this big, actually that big, and two full-time nurses, 24 hours a day. There's nothing I could do without not having a nurse here and a nurse there, protecting me from hurting myself. I don't know what would happen if I fell down and hit my head, but they were with me 24/7, and went through. You wouldn't believe the amount of testing I went through. It was crazy.
We need to move on.
Okay, but anyhow, that led to surgery. My grandfather was a furniture maker. In fact, he designed and helped construct the Hi-Li fields in Cuba, in Havana. But I always had a feeling towards working with wood. In Citala, I spent a lot of time with the woodworkers. Trailwillies are woodworkers. And they built everything with machetes and axes. I mean, they fit all the wood, they chop and so on. And I loved working with them. It was a lot of fun. In fact, one job that I took in the milpas, because I was too big and too whatever to squat and plant all day, is to sharpen stones. I sharpened their machetes and sharpened their hitsuos, which are hoes. And that was my participation in the farming, agricultural part of Citala. But since then, and after that, after the surgery, I went to college and came out, and there was a friend of mine across the road building a boat, and I started hanging out with him. And I worked for over a year working on that boat. And then I decided I was hooked on woodworking. And I built a little shop, and I opened up a company, and opened up another company, and got hired by someone. And then I was doing construction management, and I just cut out everything and said, nah, I'm going to be a furniture maker. Stopped everything else and built a shop and started building.